until they give me the right to get M1 Abrams tank and be able to drive over all the cars that get in my way. We'll just have to deal with it as it comes our way. Let's see, Elizabeth is here. Cadence is here. Nick is here. Gage and Eli. All right, everyone else is probably stuck in traffic. All right. Let's see if I can be successful, get us through what we need to get through, because we need to get our second exam in before we go on spring break, which is next week, right? Or is it 2 weeks?
Next week.
Next week. All right. See, I've lost track. All right. So we're dealing with federalism, and if I can get through this quick, we'll go over the pros and cons of federalism. There's a handout on my website. I was going to do it on class on when we were here last, but there was no internet in the room, so I couldn't do it. So internet's up. We'll review that. But again, you can download it and study it and add it to your materials. All right. So we know that our federalist system, the relationship between the federal government, the state government, local government, has changed over time. And the change has been spurred by events, historical events. And advocates of these changes or resistance to that change, that's politics. So at no point am I saying what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad. This is just how history has changed the rules of the game. So up until the 1960s, the country, politically, ideologically, was going in the left direction. People were, based on their life experience, were demanding more governmental activity and intrusion upon their daily lives. And if they tried resisting, like that Atlanta motel case that got up to the Supreme Court, the government shut them down. The government had its agenda trying to basically allow for socialism, where the government regulates all aspect of life. The government makes the determination of what's good, what's bad. And yes, there is that element of redistribution that's in there. So to help somebody who may be in need, the government must take from somebody who has. But ultimately, the decisions were made by DC. Well, the pendulum went so far to my left, well, this would be your left, that as what usually happens, politically speaking, the pendulism stopped and started coming back the other way because it went beyond what the American people wanted. And beginning in the early 1981, with the emergence of Ronald Reagan as president, the pendulum began swinging away from overreaching government intervention in the lives of the people. It began what political scientists refer to as an age of new federalism. The primary doctrine of the since the New Deal was preemption, where basically the federal government could preempt all actions. Well, that got so far, we saw the Wicker case, we saw the Atlanta hotel case, where the government was basically telling people what to do in their own spaces. Well, beginning really with the Nixon administration, new political theories began to emerge to counter preemption. And this was known as the doctrine of devolution. Devolution. And by the way, that's the reason why many books and sources refer to when Reagan became president, the Reagan Revolution. Because what ended up happening is the political tenets or the currents began rejecting preemption by marking a shift. Devolution is like it looks like. It's evolution in reverse. what they wanted to do is to devolve the power of the federal government, to take things that should have been left with the states and moving them back to the states. Initially, it was proposed by Nixon, but Nixon had to deal with a Democrat Congress, so the Nixon administration could not push it too far. But when Reagan came in, he implemented it. And all across the board, you started seeing efforts to basically take federal actions and return it to the states. Heck, Ronald Reagan once famously said, and I'm going to butcher this quote, essentially, one of the most scary words in the English language, "Hi, I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Well, why is that? Well, if the government shows up at your house, they're not going to help you. They're going to impose their will upon you. So, those advocates that were involved in the Reagan Revolution were essentially advocating for positions that were once advocated by Jefferson and Madison. The half of the founding fathers that wanted a more state-centered federal government. Not a national government-centered federalist system. And they had a constitutional argument. That's the whole reason why the 10th Amendment exists. The 10th Amendment literally says that if, essentially, the Constitution is silent, in other words, it's not telling the federal government it can do something, that means those powers are to be left by the state to the states and the people thereof. Or actually, to read it verbatim, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So, beginning with the Ronald Reagan administration, Reagan began using block grants, government funding given to the states, but allowing the states to implement the programs. So instead of passing a law that says the states have to do 1, 2, 3, devolution is, here's some federal funds, you fix the problem yourself.
How'd that work over pretty well?
Well, yeah. Well, that's fast forward from Reagan to now, that's what DOGE is doing.
Right.
They're actually looking at all of those programs that the states were supposed to be running and how are they doing it. Well, it's turning out they're not running them too well.
Okay.
So what could be the result? Well, you're going to cut those funds off. Because if you're not using the money for what it's supposed to go to, why are we going to give you money?
Right.
Is it controversial? Hell yeah.
Is it still going on?
Oh, absolutely. Every single day they're still finding things and they're exposing it. And the people that were living off of those programs, they're going to be impacted.
Oh, yeah.
Huge.
I'm still reading about all the federal cuts and everything he's making still.
But it comes down to, is that where our money should be going?
Like, I understand what he's doing with the whole federal profit cut and stuff like that, but I think he's going a little crazy with it, to be honest with you.
Well, if you're going to find it, are you going to stop when the findings get really bad? Or are you just going to flush it all out, bringing it into the public square, and let's have a conversation about it?
I agree with that's what should be done. But in like some aspects of some of the things he's doing...
Well, remember, DOGE does not have the authority to cut the spending. What they're doing is they're identifying it, and it's Congress that's going to make the cuts.
Okay. They're just finding out where it went.
Right. So here you go. Here's $1 billion that went to this program. So DOGE will notify Congress, and then it's up to Congress and their funding bills
do we want to keep funding it or not?
Oh. So do you think they'll even look at that because so many people are against what DOGE is doing, especially people in government status?
Yeah, I think they're going to keep going, but what's going to end up happening is all of the doom and gloom that the particularly the left-wing media is trying to propagate, it's not going to come to fruition.
Okay.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, what's something that I was reading? Oh, I actually read, there was a story in the Telegram Gazette this morning about what's called 504.
I read something about that. What?
504s is something to do with special ed eligibility in high school. So the schools get funds to basically help disabled people, whether they're physically disabled or they have learning challenges,
right,
and basically give them equal opportunity. But some of the stuff I've read has also said that that's been abused because it's a shortcut instead of putting a kid on an IEP.
Okay.
So, you know, is it being used properly? I don't know. But if the government takes it all away, you're going to have a lot of kids that are going to be impacted by that, and that might not be a good thing.
Now, is that what Trump wants, to take that away?
Trump has never said anything, but this was just something that was discovered.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So what I'm saying is that nothing has been taken away yet. Things have been identified.
Okay.
So, to bring it back full circle, yeah. So, they started this program, and then 25 years later, it morphed into what we're dealing with now. So, is it a good thing? Don't know.
To be continued.
To be continued. Well, that's the thing about history and politics. Right. Everything is to be continued.
For sure.
But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be aware of it. And we shouldn't be attentive to it.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, new socialism preemption, that was supported by the Supreme Court. Well, devolution, also, in order for it to be successful, also had to be supported by the Supreme Court. And as it turns out, beginning in the 1980s, something weird began happening to the Supreme Court. It started going from radical left, which it had been since the New Deal, to slowly switching back towards a more centrist approach. Going into 1990, the court ideologically was divided, where you had four real hardcore left liberals, you had three conservatives, and then you had two justices that were also often referred to as swing justices. Meaning, sometimes they went with the left, sometimes they went with the right.
Would that be somebody you would identify as an individual voter or whatever? If you don't identify as a Democratic or Republican, isn't it like independent?
Independent, yeah. But I'm talking about Supreme Court justices, so we're talking about their ideologies. So by left of center, that means that it doesn't necessarily align to Democrats, but what it has to do is it aligns with a more progressive viewpoint, whereas the right refers to a more conservative, contextual, ideological basis.
Okay.
But from when FDR threatened to pack the court all the way up until the 90s, the court was left. But now it started going back to the center. So what you started seeing is for the first time since the 1930s, the Supreme Court telling Congress, no, you cannot do this. It's beyond your power. Ironically, one of the most consequential cases was a case that should have never, or rather, if you were going to predict things, would have never been on your radar. U.S. v. Lopez, 1995. This case involved a senior in a Texas high school. Kid by the name of Alfonso Lopez Jr. He brought into school an unloaded 38 caliber revolver, a pistol. Why? Well, he claimed he was delivering it to another person. So he was a mule. He got paid to bring the gun in and give it to somebody else. Now, here's the thing. In Texas, at the time, it was not illegal for somebody 18 years or older to carry a firearm. You did not need a permit. So he was not doing anything technically illegal at the state level. But early in the Bill Clinton administration, in 1993, Congress passed a law called the Gun-Free School Zone Act. What this law did was basically say, if this is your school, there is a zone around the school in which it is illegal for anybody to possess a firearm. Well, the problem is by putting the school and putting a zone around it, what can get caught in the zones?
People's homes.
People's houses. Because it wasn't just school grounds, it was just a radius. As it turned out, the kid who was going to get the gun lived in the school zone.
Wow.
So he brought the gun in, he was going to deliver it to a kid who lived in the school zone. Under state law, this is legal. But because of this federal law, the kid unknowingly committed a federal crime. Well, if it's legal, how the hell did the feds find out? Well, apparently, the kid was busted by the dean of students in the school, got taken to the school office, started giving the staff lip, and that caused the dean of students to basically say, oh yeah, you're gonna give me attitude? And he started making phone calls. They call the local police department, and one of the cops there basically gave wind of it to the federal government. And before you know it, federal FBI agents come in and arrest the kid and charge him with a federal crime. He is facing thousands of dollars in fines and potential prison sentence in the federal penitentiary.
If Buddy's house was outside of that school zone, what do you think he would have got away with it?
Maybe. Don't know, but the problem is the kid got stuck with it in the school. If the kid had not brought the gun to school to do the transaction, instead went to the house, might have been a different situation. But it's good that it worked out this way. Kid gets found guilty in a federal court, appeals it, the appeals court upholds the decision in the trial court, gets all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Rehnquist Court, four liberals, three conservatives, two swing justices, looked at the facts of the case. They decided, by a 5-4 decision, that this law was unconstitutional. The Gun-Free School Zone Act. Why? Congress based the law on its commerce powers, its powers to regulate interstate commerce. So if you were going to argue for this law in this case, well, this was a gun sale. So that's what the court decided to look at. Because again, if a case gets up to the Supreme Court, they're not interested in the facts. They're interested in the law that's involved. So Congress makes this law based on this clause, and the court basically asks, essentially, does Congress have the constitutional authority to regulate this type of transaction? If you remember, from Gibbons v. Ogden, when Chief Justice Marshall said federal government regulates interstate commerce, and that commerce was the channels, the way in which goods moved, the good that moved, and the people that moved the goods. Well, the Rehnquist Court used that same precedent to make its decision. The channels of interstate commerce. Okay. When you think of channels, typically you think of roads, you think of railroads, you think of shipping lanes. Do you think of some kid putting a little .38 revolver in his backpack and walking? The court said, maybe. Maybe.
Instrumentalities.
Okay, what about the good? Does Congress have the right to regulate firearms? Well, yeah. Yeah, Congress can do that. But what about the activity? The actual sale itself? Does Congress have the power to regulate every single transaction, big or small, through its powers of interstate commerce regulation? Think of what the court did in Wickard. Guy can't grow his own food to feed his own livestock, because that significantly impacts interstate commerce.
I was telling my dad about that yesterday. He almost fell over.
Well, here you go. The Supreme Court focused on this third element, this third prong, and basically asked the question, how much money was being passed in this transaction? $40. Did the kid have the right to possess the gun under state law? Yeah, he did. If you have the right to possess it, guess what you can do with something?
Possess it.
Well, and if you don't want to possess it anymore?
Throw it away, give it to someone?
Yeah, you can sell it if you want to. It's yours. Yeah. Substantially affect. And this is where the big element of this case comes out. For the first time since the 1930s, the Supreme Court told Congress, you can't regulate something unless it substantially affects interstate commerce. And a $40 sale for a legal gun does not substantially affect interstate commerce. So, is this law constitutional? No.
Kid must have had a good lawyer.
Yeah. Well, it's the right decision. Constitutionally, though, it's the right decision. Questions? All right. So with devolution, you started seeing the pendulum kind of going back in the other direction. You started seeing a shift back to state-centered federalism. So in the case of Lopez, what level of law should have controlled that transaction. Well, that's a purely local transaction. And if it's legal at the state level, it should be legal. Easy as that. Now, FYI, the current court,
6-3. 6 conservatives, 3 liberals. Every time you hear about a big case in the last few years, it's involved devolution, where the Supreme Court is telling the federal government no, and it's slowly shifting the powers back to the states.
So, that was the big brouhaha when the Supreme Court declared that Roe v. Wade was decided incorrectly. That decision was wrong because there's nothing in the federal constitution that gives the federal government the authority to regulate health care. Health care is a state-centered issue. So when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, it didn't declare abortion illegal. No, it basically said the state should decide, which is, constitutionally speaking, the right decision. Because do we not have a society based upon the consent of the people? You know, so if you are a group of people in a state like Massachusetts that wants to allow abortions all the way up to the point of birth, which is the case in the Commonwealth, if that's what the majority of the people want, that's what they should get. Whereas if you live in other states, like Florida, which imposed a heartbeat ban.
A what?
A heartbeat ban. No abortions after you can detect a fetal heartbeat.
Why? That's what the majority of the people down there wanted. So at the end of the day, that's the way our system should be about, based upon the will or the consent of the people. Now, is one side right, one side wrong? That's politics. You have the freedom to believe either way. And I'm not saying either way is right, either way is wrong. The only thing I am saying from a purely constitutional sense, that the court got it right in overturning Roe v. Wade. That was a wrong decision.
In some states, they say that if you leave the state to get an abortion, if the abortion is illegal in the state, that you can be, if we go back to the state that you live in that has abortion illegal, after going to the legal state where you get the abortion, they said that you could be, like, arrested for it.
I'll get to that. I'll get to that. Because there are clauses in the Constitution that actually would prohibit that. Well, let me get to it. All right.
So now where are we at? Well, in the last 10 years, our country has gone off the freaking cuckoo's nest, out of the cuckoo's nest, or into the cuckoo's nest, because of all of the things that we've had to deal with. So, none of you were, or well, maybe one, or you were, how old are you?
32.
All right, so you were old enough to be alive when 9/11 happened, but do you remember it?
Oh, yeah. I remember where I was and everything.
Okay. How old were you? You must have been like...
I was in like the third grade.
Okay. But anybody else? Oh, you were, do you remember it?
I was like 3 years.
So that'd be new.
That's so wild to me.
Yeah. I think I was like outside on the front lawn playing, and my mom went, "Oh my God, Grant's not here." And I was like, "Whoa."
Gotcha. My son was watching Sesame Street. He was 9 months old. No, I remember that. I was folding laundry.
Right.
My wife called me up and like, "You gotta put the TV on." I'm like, "Why?" Put the TV on. I'm like, "Holy cow." But 9/11 sparked the whole war on terrorism, the passage of the Patriot Act that allowed the federal government to suddenly get to the level where, and I'm not lying to you, there are federal laws that say that the NSA, the National Security Administration, can, without notifying you, get access to all of your electrical devices. They can turn them on anytime they want. They can read all your emails. None of that is private under federal law.
Isn't that if you actually read the terms and conditions, it does state
that? And it all states that in there, yeah. Absolutely.
And why are we in that? Why can the government track all of your actions? Because of what happened. Now, did the government overstep, overreach? Yeah. But I'll be honest, I remember when it happened. I was working at another college, and I was invited to participate in a faculty debate. And I actually, at the time, bless you, argued in favor of the Patriot Act. Because at the time, I thought it was the right thing. Now, I've learned my lesson, and I would argue against it. 100% of the day, because I had no idea where the government would go with it. Although I did say, I am comfortable with the Bush administration having these powers, but I would be concerned with other administrations. So a lot of the dangers were actually put into place by the Obama administration. Just FYI. Obamacare. There's another example of federal overreach. The Obama administration got Congress to pass a law that forced you to buy health care. And if you did not buy health care approved by the federal government, you could actually lose any tax return that you might have received. And there were other penalties. So you were being forced to buy a product, because that's what health care is. Insurance is a product. Well, where does it stand today? Well, when Trump was in office in his first term, he got that penalty eliminated. So now technically Obamacare is still there, but the government cannot, federal government cannot penalize you if you don't get health care. But Massachusetts has what's called Romney Care, because it was actually implemented first in Massachusetts when Mitt Romney was governor. So in Massachusetts, you actually have to show proof of health insurance, or you will be penalized by the state. COVID? Remember what it was like during the COVID? Remember the COVIDs? As a libertarian constitutionalist, it was the most terrifying experience that I could ever imagine. Because I saw the entire mass of the American population bow down and allow them to have all of their constitutional rights stripped away. Because the government said so. And they used fear to instill terror in the people so they would comply. Like, remember when it first started 5 years ago, yesterday? Ironically, I was in the same place where I was when that happened. But when it first started, they basically said, oh yeah, stay at home for 2 weeks. That's going to be enough. Just 2 weeks, stop the spread. Don't have to do anything else, just stay at home. And then suddenly 2 weeks became a month, became, you know, all summer long. And originally they said, oh, you don't have to wear masks, don't wear masks, that would be bad. But then suddenly you had to wear masks, you had to wear all kinds of masks. But then you couldn't wear the cloth masks, you only had to wear the surgical masks, or the N95 masks. Oh, but the problem is that you couldn't get those until they were shipped over from China, which is the same place where the Wuhan lab leak occurred. But then you had to wear those, and then when one mask wasn't enough, suddenly you had to wear two masks. And then you had to do that social distancing of 6 feet. Why? Well, if you pay attention to all of the hearings that have happened since, they just made all that stuff up. Remember, you couldn't walk in the same opposite path in the grocery store. You had to follow those little arrows. Yeah. Because the arrow was going to keep you from getting COVID. Yeah. Yeah. All of that was fiction. The Health and Human Services Department actually had on their website, before it was scrubbed, when Biden came in, they actually had a definitive study that said the masks do not stop the spread of any type of viral pathogen. That essentially they're there for placebo. But yet we were told we had to wear these, and you weren't going to get it. But the people that were wearing the masks all the time were the ones who were getting it. And then they told us we all had to get shots, even though in order to get a normal medication through, it has to go through years and years and years of testing and study. But what did they do? They had this super wonderful inoculation that was based on changing the genetic code of human beings, that mRNA stuff.
But you had to take that. And that would keep you from getting sick or spreading it until it didn't. Everything that came out was just based on lies.
And then that guy retired out of the face of the blue.
Fauci retired and Biden gave him a full per pardon.
Didn't Trump just remove the security detail?
Yes, he did.
And then the Johnson & Johnson vaccine got a whole lawsuit over it because mm-hmm. it was proven to like cause like cancer.
Yeah, but the Biden administration imposed protections on all of the data for 95 years.
Of course they did.
So you're not even going to be able to see what if they did any testing and what were the results until we're long dead.
See, that's like the next generation. I wonder if because, like you said, it changed your generics, that shot or whatever. So when, say if like a guy that has a shot and a girl that has a shot, or a girl or a guy that doesn't have a shot, but whatever, get together and have a child, that child, the next generation,
don't know.
Different.
Don't know what's going to happen. Don't know what's going to happen. But I can tell you this much. Have you ever heard of eugenics?
No.
Eugenics was a fad that was beginning in the 20th century where they basically wanted to control human reproduction by basically breeding a super race. It was the ideology that would give rise to the Nazis. Although it started in American colleges. There are many academics, if you go and you read papers and you listen to the speeches, that basically said that they have an aim to basically reduce the surplus population on the earth right now, because there's too many people.
Control.
Yeah. So it could be part of that.
I agree.
Now, here's the thing. I don't know what's right. I don't know what's wrong. I only can just, I hear things, and I try listening, and I try learning. But this all goes to the question of, how much power do you want DC to have? Do you trust them to make the right decisions? Or would you rather have those decisions made at a state level or a local level where you as an individual might have more of an impact, more of a control? There are people that still say, let the federal government do it. But there are others that say no. The battle that began when our Constitution was ratified is still going on. It just might not be articulated in the way I just did. So where are we going to go from here? Don't know. But there will still be politics. There will still be arguments. There will still be debates. All right. How does the federal government get compliance? Simple. Since the progressive era, the federal government has used money to get the states to comply with federal policies. As I said to you before, with money comes control. If I give you money, I can tell you what to do because you are obligated to me for that money. So, grants began in the progressive era. But during the cooperative period, especially during LBJ's Great Society, that's really where grant monies exploded. And it resulted in what you could argue was continuous collaboration. Basically, federal government says, we want this policy, here's money to the states, and the states say, okay, we're going to do it. With no checks, no pushback. Because the states want the money. But you know what they don't do? They don't read the details. So I'll give you one example and then I'll get back into more substantive stuff. So 12, 13, 14 odd years ago, I was on the school committee in my town, and the superintendent at the time applied for a grant. It was called Race to the Top. The federal government was going to give school systems who applied for this grant $75,000 cash. And you were going to use that money to, I think it was supposed to bolster Title I. Title I is a program that's offered in schools to help kids, particularly in the elementary schools, that cannot effectively communicate, you know, grammatically, spelling-wise, so it just helps them with their reading and writing skills.
what used to be called English back when I was a kid, but I think now it's, is it ELA, English Language Arts? Is that what it's still called?
I don't know if it's still called that, but I remember it being called
that. Okay.
Yeah, it was just English, you know, back in the day. Because, well,
in like high school or
down in the elementary school, where you learn how to read, write, you know, grammar, spelling, ELA. Yeah, that's English language arts.
English language arts.
Okay. Well, when I was a kid, we used to have separate class. We had a spelling class, we had a grammar class, we had a reading class. We had, you know, we had those all separate classes. Now they just kind of squished it together. But anyways, so Title I was this federal program where schools could apply and get this money, and they could use it to help kids who are struggling with reading and writing. And who doesn't want to help a young kid who's struggling with reading and writing? Well, I asked the superintendent, what are the terms and the conditions? What's the fine print of the grant? He's like, oh, no, it'll be no big deal, no big deal. It'll be good. We can use this money, one time's money, and then we run out with it. We don't have to worry about it. Applies for the grant, gets the grant, signs the endorsement, gets the money, and then the terms come through. When we got that grant, we had to switch over to Common Core, which was a federally mandated program for curriculum that came out of the Obama administration, which meant we had to get rid of the curriculum that we had for English, language arts, and math, K to 12. So we went out, we got a $75,000 grant, and it ended up costing the town close to $1 million. Because we had to buy all new books, all new curriculum, all the teachers had to be trained up on this new stuff. Why? With money comes control. If the government gives you a little bit of money, they can tell you what to do. Now, your book, if you're reading the chapters in the book, your book does mention several types of grant programs that are available from the federal government. And I'm going to give you a breakdown of the big five. No, I'm apparently not. There we go. I knew it would come there. All right, so what did I say before? Grant programs serve several purposes. Grant comes in different forms. All right, that's fine. Then this is where I'll explain what each one is. All right, the first common form of grants that come from the federal government are called categorical grants. These are grants that the federal government gives to the states for just broad categories. For example, I forgot what the exact grant was called, but there is a grant that states can get federal monies for the use in construction and renovation of school buildings. A lot of the buildings, you know, if you've went to Worcester, some of the school buildings are 100 plus years old. There's lead in there, there's asbestos in there, and it costs thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to clean them up beyond the ability of the local town or city to pay for it. So the state can tap federal funds that can then be distributed to the towns to clean up the schools. So that's a categorical grant. School repair. There's also grants out there for like road repair or for bridges or culverts, infrastructure. So to put it another way, the federal government's kind of saying what they have to be used for, but in a broad fashion. Similarly, there are what's known as block grants. A categorical grant goes to a purpose, a specific thing. A block grant is more open-ended in terms of subject area. So you can apply and get categorical grant funds to build a new school, which obviously you only can use that money for a new school. But there are block grants available for just education. So you can apply to get extra money, like my superintendent friend did. Oh, let's get this money to help our kids improve reading and writing skills. That would be part of a
Block grant. There are also revenue sharing grants. This is outwards redistribution.
The federal government doesn't make the states apply if they just have surplus money. They take it and they just send it to the states. This is commonly done through what's called PORC. When we talk about Congress, we'll talk about PORC. PORC are line items in budgets where basically federal monies are sent back to the district.
There are also formula grants. Formula grants where a particular jurisdiction can apply for money, but they're only going to get it based on a formula.
So meaning, if Massachusetts applies for one of these grants and Rhode Island applies for one of these grants, they're not going to get the same money, depending upon what the formula is.
So Massachusetts uses formula grants for the towns for schools.
There's a program, funding, known as Chapter 90. Wait, no, Chapter 7. 90 is roads, 70 is schools. So basically the state government gives money to the schools based on the total student population. But not all towns get the same. Because what the state does is they looked at how wealthy a town is. So, do you have a high percentage of low-income residents? Well, if that's the case, that town may get more money than another town of equal size that is judged to be more well-to-do. So, basically, there's a formula that's involved.
And last but not least, there's project grants,
where you actually have a project in mind and you apply based on that project. So maybe your town wants to make a new park. There are actually federal park grants available. So in your application, you would basically say, this is the park, this is what we want to do, here's the amount of handicapped spaces, here are our handicapped accessible, you know, swing equipment and apparatus, playground stuff. And the federal government will basically decide, okay, based on that park, we'll give the money for that park. So, categorical grants. Schools, bridges, roads, broad categories. Block grants, purposes, education. Clean water, things like that. Revenue sharing, here's $5. Formula grants, there's a mechanism behind it. Not all applicants are going to get the same amount based on whatever the formula is. And then project grants, well, you're specifically applied based on a project that you have. Questions? Do you have a question? Oh, I thought I saw your hand. Okay. All right, are there limits on the federal government's ability to use money to compel outcomes? Interestingly, yes, there is. There is a case that got up to the Supreme Court in which the Supreme Court established a test that the Congress must pass if it's going to use grant money to compel behavior. And it was a test that was established in the case South Dakota v. Dole. I like this case. In 1984, Congress passed what is called the National Minimum Drinking Age Act of 1984, in which the federal government mandated that the drinking age should go from 18 to 21.
Why? Well, a bunch of high school kids were getting liquored up, getting in their cars, and killing themselves. So it was decided, let's increase it to 21. But, there's a problem. The 21st Amendment, which ended prohibition. The 21st Amendment says that anything dealing with alcohol is a state matter. So the federal government in the Constitution should have no say in a drinking age. Well, how does the Congress get around the Constitution? Well, with money comes control. In this law, it was determined that any state that did not increase its drinking age to 21, because it's actually a state-imposed drinking age, would lose 5% of its highway funds.
Why the highways?
Because how do people kill other people when they're drinking and driving? No, only 5% of the funds.
That's a lot of money.
So the state would still get 95, but you would lose 5% if you wanted to keep it at 18. And in 1988, it would increase to 10%, where it would stay thereafter. So if you're a state that is a libertarian state, live free or die state, if you want to allow 18-year-olds or 19-year-olds or 20-year-olds to buy alcohol, that's fine. You can do it. You're just going to lose some money. Well, an interesting situation developed in South Dakota. South Dakota had been allowing 19-year-olds to buy what was called near beer. Near beer is a beer that has an alcohol content of 3% or lower. Why had it been doing that? Well, interestingly enough, they made the determination that most young ladies don't like the more potent beer. So this law was actually aimed to allow women to go and buy this stuff. So South Dakota basically says, well, we think women are more responsible. By the way, guys, anything more than 3% was 21 in the state. So if you wanted to drink less, like the ladies have a tendency to do, you can buy the near beer. If you wanted to drink the big stuff, big boy drink, you had to be 21. Well, South Dakota said, this is what we want. This is what we feel is responsible. So they actually sued the federal government. Gets up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court looks at this issue. And it would develop a three-pronged test for these grants. So, if the federal government is going to use a law and check or reduce grant money to achieve an outcome, one, the purpose must be something that pertains to the general welfare. And the general welfare is commonly referred to as the common good. So, we're not targeting anyone, we're not punishing everyone, we're doing it for the good or the greater good. Two, states must have the ability to opt out. So Congress isn't trying to tell you how to act, but this is something that's for the common good, and you cannot take the money, or you can suffer the consequences if you want. And three, it must be linked to a national program. In trying to reduce highway deaths, and the highways, federal highways, are actually controlled by the federal government, yeah, that's not a bad objective. So, we're going to increase the drinking age because it's basically good for society. If you don't want to do it, you don't have to. And of course, we're doing it for a national program. So, the Supreme Court looked at South Dakota's argument and been like, look, we're not trying to punish you. If you still want to allow young people, particularly the young ladies, to drink the near beer, you can still do that. That's your choice. Because you can opt out. And if you think, you know, it's good for your society to do that, then you can do that. But just remember, this is just going to impact your highway funding. But to your point, 5% is a lot of money.
You mean 10 to 50 more. That's
yeah.
Wild.
So at the end of the day, South Dakota would eliminate that exemption for near beer and increase all alcohol purchases up to 1-1. Because that's exactly what they said. Okay, we can opt out, but we want to lose that money. We're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
Because there's not a state in this country that does not have one of those blue-shielded U.S. interstate highways. So, can the federal government impose its wills via grants? Yes. But it has to be conditional, based on that three-prong test. Questions? Well, since the South Dakota v. Dole decision, the federal government has, in recent years, gone beyond attempting to implement policy by threatening to reduce funds. And instead, they've been imposing what are known as unfunded mandates. In other words, they are setting policy, they're forcing the states to comply, but they're passing the buck. So, like what happened with the Race to the Top grant. The federal government gave us money to help our little program, but the town had to pony up and buy the curriculum. That was an unfunded mandate. So they told us to do something, but we had to use our own money to do it. Well, interestingly enough, the Supreme Court has actually pushed back at times on those unfunded mandates. So, for instance, in the case Prince v. United States, in the years after Ronald Reagan was shot and his, who was Brady? I'm trying to remember who Brady was. It was one of his secretaries, cabinet secretaries. I just don't remember which cabinet secretary he was. One of Ronald Reagan's secretaries in his cabinet got shot also, and he was paralyzed. So during the Clinton years, they took up what happened to Reagan's secretary and passed what was called the Brady Bill. It was a federal gun ban. And it imposed a requirement on CLEOs. Chief law enforcement officers, your individual chiefs, to approve or deny applications for firearm purchases. So the federal government passed a law that said, like, you cannot own any AK-47s or AR-15s. Of course, that law expired. But if someone did want to buy a gun, it had every gun sale had to be approved by the CLEO. Well, there was pushback from the Interstate Chiefs Association, and they ended up suing
and the case gets all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said no, that aspect of the Brady Bill was unconstitutional. Because there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that can tell local law enforcement officers what to do. And there was no money attached to it. It was just an order. So, Massachusetts, there's only like 700,000 gun owners, where we're not really a high gun-owning state. But think of states like Texas, where like 70% of people own guns. Imagine how much paperwork the chiefs would have to do for every single gun sale if every single one had to be approved or rejected. And then you're not getting any money. You're not getting additional staff. You're not getting secretaries or intake officers or things like that. Well, the Supreme Court said, no, that unfunded mandate, you can't do it. If you want to make the CLIOs do that, you got to give them additional funding. All right. I'll do this quick. On the website, and this show real quick, there is a link to a document that I put up here. And it's an excerpt from an old political science book that I had that does a nice breakdown. And it's in the outline section of my website of kind of like the advantages and disadvantages of federalism. Because keep in mind, our federalist system is unique. It's not like most countries in the world. Most countries have that unitary system where the national government controls everything. There is no states. There are no local municipalities. Well, Professor Lasser basically did a pro and con. And some of his arguments are on here. So, for instance, one advantage of federalism is that it's flexible. By not having the national government tell all the states what to do, it basically allows each state to kind of determine policies as they want, what they think is good for their residents. It allows for experimentation. You know, the cost of imposing a national policy is really expensive. But if a state could try something out and it fails, it's cheaper that way. Competition. Federalism allows competition. So if you have multiple states competing on policy ideas, well, it gives you an opportunity to see which one's better. There are winners, there are losers. By allowing the states to do things, you know, you're kind of keeping everybody happy. So you have strength, the union is strong. But one of the things that led to the Civil War is when D.C. started telling the states, you know, they're going to have higher tariffs, they're going to have restrictions on slavery, things like that. That's what caused the Union to fracture, because if you push people too far, they will fight back. Well, by allowing a flexible federalist system, you can kind of keep people happy, like I said about the abortion. You know, if you are pro-abortion, you want to live in a state like Massachusetts. If you are against abortion, you can freely get up and move and live somewhere else that maybe more aligns with your values. He goes into a little paragraph about the ability to control the abuses of power. Local government's the most effective way to control abuse of power. Because if you are involved in the local government, you actually live in the community with the people. So I'll tell you, I find out about when residents in Sutton are very angry when I go to the dump, or I go to the grocery store, or I go and get gas or a sandwich up at the center store. Because people say, hey, let me at it. I got something to say to you. And if they pull my ear, I will listen. And there are times when I hear things and then I will push for changes. Because maybe I wasn't aware of what's going on. Or maybe I wasn't aware that residents didn't like what we were doing. Although no one showed up at my house with pitchforks and torches yet. It happened.
Did it?
Back in the 1980s, the select board, well, it was the selectmen at that time, got so angry at the residents that they called a special town meeting, which they didn't advertise, and pushed for the purchase of 3 fire trucks, which caused property taxes to go through the roof because it's basically a debt exclusion.
Oh,
So when that happened and the people found out that they did this secret town meeting, people were, they actually showed up at one of the selectmen's house, broke a couple of windows, left some fiery piles of dog poop on the stairs from what I heard. No, but the bag is.
Oh,
okay. And so when the bag is burning and you go to step on it.
Oh, yeah. That's
classic. Yeah. What else do we got here for the advantages? So you got increase of responsiveness, opportunities for participation, the Dumbo effect. Basically, laws passed at the national level can have an important symbolic effect on the states. National law underscores the importance of an issue. Federal grant. All right, so that's the argument on the grants. All right, so you can take a look at that. There's also a whole bunch of disadvantages. Lack of accountability. Do you know what the bureaucrats are doing in D.C.? No. Cost shifting. Unfunded mandates. Well, it makes things more expensive, you know, at the local level. Lack of coordination, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So do me a favor, before you take a test, take a look at this. All right, and I got to throw one other thing because I still got 5 minutes.
This is the handout.
So this is located, I can even show you where on the website it is. So outlines, right here. Supplemental handout, the advantages and disadvantages of federalism.
Oh, okay.
Take a look at that. All right, let me finish this up because I got to go back to your question that you asked me earlier. All right. So what about the Constitution? Does the Constitution kind of keep the states in line? Yeah, to an extent. There are 4 sections in the Constitution that does it. Article 4, Section 1, the Full Faith and Credit Clause. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 1, the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2, the Interstate Rendition Clause. And Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, the Interstate Compact Clause. All right, how do these work? You said there are states that if you live in and you're not allowed to get an abortion and you go to a state that you can, then you can be punished when you come back. If that actually occurs and there is a case, that will get declared, that law, unconstitutional because of this right here, the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Under this clause, it says, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all of the privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. So, even though you live in a state where it may be illegal, if you go to a state where it is legal, you cannot be punished for engaging in legal activity in that state.
But gay marriage, right? Doing certain states that are legal?
Not anymore. That got up to the Supreme Court, and that got imposed nationally. Now, will that get thrown out? Maybe.
So right now, it can happen in any state?
Right now, you can get married in Massachusetts if you want to marry another guy, or if you're a gal, you want to get married to a gal, and that marriage will be recognized by all 50 states.
How long has it been like that? A while?
Since the Obergefell decision, which I think was in 2014.
Oh, okay.
I think that was the case, and I think that was the year. It might have been 2015.
It's kind of like, since Puerto Rico is a part of the United States, their legal drinking age is 18. You can go there and have like alcohol as many times as you want and then come back to the States and not be like punished for that.
Correct. Now, to my knowledge, Puerto Rico gets away with that, even though they're a territory, because they don't have any federal highways down there.
Puerto Rico doesn't have highways?
No.
Because it's an island. It's basically dirt road.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, particularly when you go on the south side of the island. Yeah, it's very rural.
Think about it. Alaska probably doesn't have highways, does it?
They do.
Really?
They do. But the interstate highway is interrupted because it has to go through Canada. All right. Full faith and credit. Real simple. If you are punished in one state, another state has to recognize that punishment. Or if you have a will or you own property in one state, It has to be recognized in another. That's what the full faith and credit clause is all about. So, for instance, real life story, and I know I'm going to run close to the time, but I got to get through this anyway. So, I had a student a few years ago that was renting an apartment, hated his landlord, and decided, I'm not going to pay him, I'm just going to ditch because I don't live in Massachusetts. And I warned him, you know what the landlord's going to do? He's going to go to the local trial court. He is going to file a claim against you. You are not going to show up. He's going to get what's called a default judgment, an automatic win. And then under the full faith and credit clause, he can take that win, go to your home state, file it in that state system, and your home state court system will enforce the decision made in Massachusetts. That's because of the full faith and credit clause. Privileges and immunities, we've already talked about that. Interstate rendition clause. If you commit a crime in Massachusetts and you flee to South Carolina and you get pulled over in South Carolina and that cop sees there's a warrant for your arrest in Massachusetts, you're going to get arrested in South Carolina and you're going to get extradited. You're going to get put on a plane and sent back to Massachusetts. That's what that Luigi?
Luigi Mangione.
That's what happened to him.
Yep.
Yeah, he fled the state, but he got extradited back to New York. And last, interstate compact clause. Very simple. States are allowed to make agreements between themselves, but any agreement has to be approved by Congress. So, the example that I have in my notes is all of the states that are on the Atlantic coast belong to what's called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. And it's an agreement between 15 states where they basically make the rules for fishing. So they all kind of make sure that, you know, if you have a fisherman that's licensed in Massachusetts and he accidentally sails into New Hampshire waters, you know, that he's not going to be punished for it because he's licensed in Massachusetts. But in order for the states to make those type of compacts, the federal government has to sign off on it. So the federal government theoretically could say no. All right, now, because many people are not physically here, we're going to have the exam today, this week, but I'm not going to make it tomorrow. Because I want you to have a chance to go and read the advantages and disadvantages. I want you to have a chance to read those clauses. So we're still going to have class on Wednesday, but Wednesday is going to have nothing to do with the exam, which I'll have on Thursday. Would that be all right? Thursday or Friday?
So we're starting a new unit on Wednesday?
So we're going to start for exam 3 on Wednesday, but you'll have your exam on Thursday or Friday, whichever you would want, which day. I don't want to have it over break, though. How many people want Thursday?
Thursday's cool.
Thursday it is. All right, so it will be like the first exam. I'll open it up at 8 a.m. You'll have until 11:59. It's the same structure. There are 30 multiple choice questions. There is a matching section on all of the major Supreme Court cases that we covered. And then there will be two essays within. You can answer both for 20, or you only have to answer one because the other one will be extra credit. All right?
Quick question.
Yes.
Do you remember at the beginning of the semester when you asked us what kind of government we are, or something like that? We are a federalist society, right?
Federal republic.
Federalism. Republic.
Federal constitutional republic. Comprised of 50 independent and sovereign states.
So we're a republic.
We are a republic,
okay.
Yes.
Understood. Thank you.
Have a good day.
I was checking out Blackboard. I think I might have been absent when you talked about it. It's a research paper number 2.
Research paper number 2?
Yeah.
You should always say research paper. You know, I was screwing with Blackboard because what I'm trying to do is I know I screwed it up. I want it so that way all of the weights are reflective in your average on Blackboard.
Yeah.
I've already screwed it up because I know everybody technically has an F for the term. Because I couldn't quite figure out how to do it. So then I modeled in, take care of you. I put in like all 4 exams in the paper to see if I could get that and get it to work, and it didn't do it. We'll see him. But yeah, there's only one paper. And the paper's due at the end of the semester.
What is
this? Oh, it's just
U.S. government.
It's just our final paper.
Yeah, your research
paper. Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
It's not like a homework or anything.
No. All
right. Thank you. All right. You have a good one. I'll see you.
Yeah, you too. See you on Wednesday. It's technology. They suck at technology.